Steve?
Yes.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, good afternoon. Paul Wallace on behalf of the State of Delaware, the appellant in this matter. This matter has kind of an unusual procedural background to it, mainly because this was one of the cases in which the Superior Court had made a conflicting decision about the constitutionality of the operation of a motor vehicle causing death statute. In fact, in this case, the Superior Court, sitting here in Kent County, had decided that, in fact, it was unconstitutionally vague and or that it could not be enforced or it was not enforceable without including a mens rea, the general mens rea from Section 251 of Title 11. The matter was stayed as Hoover was decided by this court earlier, or I should say later last year, in which this court decided those two questions in a manner that was inconsistent, in effect reversing the decision on those two questions. But Hoover left open, and the appellee has raised the one issue that he did preserve in Atkins' case down below, whether or not due process is violated with a sentence of up to 2.5 years for what is, in effect, a strict liability offense. This strict liability offense, however, is a little different. As the state suggested in its brief, the jurisprudence on this coming from Morissette isn't terribly clear. In fact, in Morissette, what it notes is when trying to discern whether or not a particular statute is a strict liability offense, one of the factors to be looked for or looked at is the relative, whether or not the penalty is relatively small or whether or not it does grave injustice to one's reputation. In looking at that after Morissette.
Yeah, Mr. Wallace, just yes, to clarify where we are procedurally at this point, I gather that both sides agree that the order below must be reversed, that is, insofar as it holds the underlying statute unconstitutional.
I believe we both agree on that as far as the two questions answered by Hoover.
Okay, so contrary. The only issue, if there is one, is the one that you were addressing. That
yes.
Is whether the potential of, what is it, 30-month?
Yes.
Sentence on its face violates due process?
Yes. That was the question left unanswered in the Hoover decision.
My question to you is it an on-its-face argument that we're dealing with here, or is this an issue that would require some factual context? That is it a ripe issue where there hasn't been any sentence imposed?
That's a very I don't need to tell the court, obviously, it's an interesting question, but the jurisprudence following Morissette seems to be that you do look at the statute on its face. If you look at the other cases out of the Third Circuit, for instance, other state cases involving those types of question, it does appear to be on its face, that there need not be a sentencing necessarily for the court to look at. In fact, if there was a sentencing to look at, the state would suggest respectfully it probably is not so much a due process question as it may be an Eighth Amendment question as to whether or not it is grossly disproportionate. Because when you look at gross disproportionality, you do look at the statute first, you look at the nature of the offense first and foremost, but there are other things that may be looked at. The court did so in Crosby, for instance.
You indicated that this issue was preserved below, and did the defendant cite Morissette? In it below?
Yes, the defendant did cite Morissette. Interestingly, Judge Young just never reached Morissette because it had decided, the Superior Court had decided the vagueness question and the mens rea question first and really left that open. Now, I can't say that the court never discussed the penalties at all because it did in one small part where it discussed it really in the context of the Morissette analysis. But it never came out, and because it never said, this is a strict liability offense, the only question left is whether this strict liability offense would offend due process by having this type of penalty. And it seems and that those are two separate questions, but as I said in my brief and I said earlier, it's a little murkier because there are different ways
to go. There are two choices, as I read your brief, for us in this appeal. Or I guess three. Well, let's stay with two choices. One would be to say we're going to look at the 30 months, and to the extent that's a potential sentence, whether you are incarcerated for 30 months or not, we'll decide whether that possibility violates due process. And the alternative is, like Crosby, to wait and see what the sentence is. And if on sentencing the person got 30 days or 30 months, let them make the argument that their sentence was violated the Constitution for the same reason Crosby did.
Yeah, yes, those really are the two choices.
So why should we do the first? I think everyone would like us to answer this question. So tell us why we should deal directly with the due process issue based on the plain reading of the statute and the possibility of 30 months.
I believe there are a couple of reasons. One, that the court is in a good position to do so and should do so. I believe the court's in a good position to do so because the court has already decided Hoover, so those questions are set aside. As the court's well aware, during Hoover, many of these matters were stayed, and in fact, they are in effect stayed right now. There are motions dismissed pending in the Newcastle County court right now of nine of these cases.
Has anyone picked up on the end of the Hoover opinion and said, we're not addressing the constitutionality of the potential sentence? Is that been adjudicated by any superior court judge?
The criminal defendants have picked up on that clearly, and that's why they have filed motions to dismiss. There are, I believe, 8 to 9 matters pending before they have been consolidated before Judge Scott right now, and he has not yet decided it. In fact, this morning I got notice the state has filed its response, which quite honestly looks much like this brief, and the Superior Court has permitted the movements to respond, I believe, by the 21st of February. That's one reason. I believe also, Your Honor, because of the record that was made in Hoover, as the court's well aware, this court asked for a great deal of supplemental information regarding specifically sentencing patterns in this case, under this statute. And I believe that what is very clear is it's a sentencing pattern that makes a great deal of sense. Few people have been incarcerated. I believe it was 7 to 8% at the most. Most of them have been folks who the charge actually started as a greater charge and was pled down, and their jail time normally was time served. In fact, what we've seen out of that sentencing pattern, I'd suggest, is pretty much what the legislature expected and was told that they probably would expect. There's a wide range of behavior that may fall under this, some of which may have a more de minimis initial violation of Title 21. But now, for instance, the state had provided the court with State versus Sharpley, the recent decision by the Newcastle County Superior Court, which found someone guilty of operation of motor vehicle causing death as a lesser included offense of criminally negligent homicide. In that case, the person violated three different motor vehicle statutes, two of which the court said contributed to the death of this person. So,
Mr. Wallace,
yes, Your Honor.
One of the problems is that the jurisdiction that we have is the jurisdiction to exercise appellate review, and the issue that the state is asking us to decide is one that hasn't been decided yet by the trial court. That is, we don't yet have anything to review. So that suggests perhaps a third alternative, and that is that the case could be remanded for the trial judge to determine, as a matter of first impression, the due process issue that you're asking us to determine as a matter of first impression.
I understand the court's concern. In reality, actually, the state didn't ask. It was the appellee who asked first and actually asked for the court to affirm the Superior Court on grounds different than what the Superior Court had initially.
Well, you may not have asked, but you're certainly not disputing that position. So, in effect, you're joining in.
The state does see the importance and the fact that I believe, and the state cited Lewis versus State to the court, that on occasion, when you're in such an unusual procedural posture that a matter could be decided, and it's in the best interest of judicial economy and in the interest of justice to decide it prior to the matter going back for trial, that could be done. And I suggest respectfully, Your Honor, that this really is a question of law. Of straight law that would have plenary review by this court in any instance. And the law, as far as what the bounds of possible sentences or penalties for a strict liability offense, would allow this court to decide the matter, and I believe decide the matter in a way that upholds constitutionality of this statute against the due process claim that's brought.
Mr. Wallace, is there any analogy to be drawn to the situation where we determine whether or not an individual has the right of appeal? In other words, do we look at whether someone was sentenced to 10 days in jail and a $10 fine, or, and then declare because you weren't sentenced more than 6 months or a fine greater than $100, you have no right of appeal, even when the potential sentence could have been 6 months and a fine of $100? Is there any analogy there?
Well, I believe that could be a concern because given the nature of this statute and the nature of some of the sentences that that have been passed in this case, certainly some of them have fallen below the appellate jurisdiction of this court. This matter, these cases are in the original jurisdiction of Superior Court. In other words, there's only going to be one level of review, if there is any, once the matter is brought. And if the person, in fact, is convicted. Therefore, if, for instance, there is an on-its-face due process problem with this statute because of the potential penalty that someone faced, they may be out of luck, really, as far as their ability to have it reviewed. Now,
well, statistically, are most of these people who are getting, let's say, use the vernacular, no jail time, are they nevertheless having suspended sentences and being placed on probation for 6 months or more?
I would say that probably statistically most aren't being placed on probation. A lot of them seem to be fine. I don't believe most of them are being placed on getting jail terms longer than 30 days that are suspended. But that's just my rough sense from the Hoover material, but I'd have to look back to it. I can't say that there's going to be a great number that may have no ability to appeal. But I know that I can think of some that have been fined less than $100.
Yeah, well, my concern wasn't really whether they had a right to appeal or not, but by analogy, in looking at whether one has a constitutional right to appeal or not, at least in Delaware, since it's still one of the few remaining things that's a state question, do we look at that in terms of what the actual sentence was or what the potential sentence was? And in addressing this, do we look at what the actual sentence was, or do we look at what the potential sentence was in dealing with the due process issue?
I'd have to say that the majority of courts that have looked at the due process question look at the potential sentence and not the actual sentence. That is my reading of both the state and federal courts that have decided Morissette.
If that's, for the sake of argument, if that's the case here, how do we interpret Morissette in light of a potential 30-month sentence?
Well, the problem is then becomes when we talk about Morissette, it talks about a relatively small penalty, but relative to what it really becomes the question. When we look at the Morissette jurisprudence, it depends on the nature of the strict liability offense. In fact, the only strict liability offense to be struck down by the United States Supreme Court was in Lambert versus California, which was a felony which had really passive conduct.
But when we look at the constitutional right to appeal or the absence of one in Delaware, and we look at what the potential sentence would be, what do we find to be the line that's drawn in terms of significant enough to be a catalyst for appeal and so insignificant as not to be a catalyst for appeal?
Well, if the person actually receives 30 days. again, if the potential sentence is up to 5 years, but the person only gets a 15-day sentence, he has no right to appeal.
In your view, are the due process arguments and the Eighth Amendment arguments connected, or if we rule in the state's favor in this case on the due process argument, and we say the potential of 30 months is fine, and then matters go forward, and hypothetically someone violates the motor vehicle statute in the most innocuous way, just assume that, but it results in a death, and they get 30 months, can they then come in and say, well, my violation was so de minimis, I realized it was a death, but 30 months is cruel and unusual, like Crosby? Or if we decide the potential of 30 months doesn't violate due process, is that argument taken away?
I don't know that it's foreclosed because specifically of Crosby, and that is the court did not simply throw away the habitual offender statute. It simply said in this rare circumstance, and in fact Hammerlin says that, it's that rare, very rare circumstance that may bring about gross disproportionality, and the state sees in almost every offense that there always is that rare possibility. I believe that the Eighth Amendment, and that's why the state argued it in its brief, still gives the ability. The state's also confident that really what happens is it's a sentencing judge before that happens, and also a wide body of sentencing law under this statute, which seems to make it clear that that rare case won't happen. But there may be that case for which, because the defendant, for instance, has a terrible driving record, and it is not an innocuous situation, and there may be multiple deaths where they may reach towards that 30 months. It can happen. I see that I am in my
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I would like to, Your Honor, if I may. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Justice Holland. First of all, I want to thank the Court. You had originally given me permission to appear without a jacket. I had fractured my right wrist. But I went and saw my doctor on Monday and said, look, I don't go to the Supreme Court too often. Is there any way I can get it off? And he took it off. So, but I just still want to thank you that you had given me permission for that. I think this issue is right. What had happened is, of course, my case was the one that was stayed pending Hoover. And once the Hoover decision came out, Mr. Wallace, in fact, called me and said, what do you want to do? And I basically hadn't even reviewed Hoover at that point. And I said, let me review it, and I'll let you know. Had it not stated at the end, the last couple of pages, about the punishment issue, the relatively small penalty, and the Morissette, I probably would have said, I agree, it should be sent back. But as soon as this court brought that issue up, it seemed to me a legitimate issue which should be decided.
Well, Mr. Morris, the issue may be ripe in the sense that some court can now decide it. But should it be this court?
I believe so. And the argument is, again, I think, and Mr. Wallace, I think, hit it right, that the cases that I've seen, the due process, they do look at the potential penalty here. And even though Judge Young didn't specifically use the language, I think he did address the penalty aspect of it. And interestingly enough, Judge Graves did address this very issue in the Cordry decision, which was one of the cases that were stayed pending Hoover. But if you look at Judge Young's decision, which I believe didn't use the magic words relatively small penalty, I think he addressed the, in fact, his language was dire penalties based upon the factual pattern.
Are you telling us that he ruled, made a due process ruling in his opinion? That is, that he ruled that a potential of 30 months for, a violation of this statute would violate federal due process?
I think he considered it, but because of the first two issues, he didn't make that final leap and make that relatively small penalty assessment as Morissette set out. but I think he did at least discuss that he thought the penalties were dire. So,
well, the issue, I mean, the question is whether that we would be sitting here reviewing a decision of Judge Young, or whether we would be deciding this matter in the first instance. And if it's the latter, which I gather you agree you're asking us to do, is that a prudential way of using this court's resources?
I would say normally it isn't, Your Honor, but the fact that this court, in an en banc decision, raised this very issue and specifically said, and I guess the interesting question would have been, had that been one of the certified questions, had it been done, I guess, properly the first way around in the Hoover decision, I probably wouldn't be here today. But for whatever reason, and again, I didn't propose the certified questions to the court. I believe it was probably Mr. Wallace and someone else for the Newcastle County case. Had they made that extra step to include that, yes, I wouldn't be here today.
Well, let me ask this question. You've mentioned that Judge Graves has decided this issue in a case that's not before us. And Mr. Wallace mentioned that there are at least seven cases stayed and pending before a Superior Court judge in Newcastle County. Do you know whether any of those seven cases have a Morissette issue as well as a Hoover issue in front of them?
I think they do. In preparing for this, I had spoken to the public defender's office, who was handling most of the cases, Bernie O'Donnell, and I know he has prepared, I believe, numerous of the motions that are now pending in the Superior Court, or at least had given them to the trial counsel. So, but I don't think, the court hasn't addressed it yet, even though it's.
No, I know that. I understand the court hasn't addressed it. I'm concerned that the court has stayed it, waiting for a decision from us, and.
I'm not aware that the cases were stayed. In fact, I think Mr. Wallace had made a request to President Judge Vaughn to stay these issues. In fact, what happened procedurally, Your Honor, is Mr. Wallace called me and said, what do you want to do, Greg? And I said, look, let me review decision. Once I looked at decision, I said, the Supreme Court looks like it really wants to do it. Mr. Wallace then wrote to the court and said, he was going to be asking the President Judge Vaughn to stay all the cases until potentially this court would deal with that issue. Judge Vaughn, once he got that request, denied that request to stay the cases. So I'm not aware of any case. I know in Kent County the cases are not stayed. In fact, what happened is Judge Vaughn's office contacted me after the Hoover decision and said, we need to get your case on for trial. And I said, Your Honor, we can't do that yet because my case is actually pending in the Supreme Court at this point. So I don't know why the cases are stayed, and maybe Mr. Wallace can address that.
Well, my understanding is, from what Mr. Wallace said, that the Morissette issue is going to be before Judge Scott in these seven cases, and that they're moving forward, and the next brief is due on February 21st. In the interim, we know from the Cordry case that Judge Graves already addressed the Morissette issue, and he said he saw no problems. So to the extent the issue was highlighted in Hoover, now Judge Scott needs to decide if he's going to come out the same way that Judge Graves did or come out a different way, in which event we would then have a conflict between two Superior Court judges as we did when Hoover got here.
Correct.
So this case, the appeal you're now arguing, is moving on a parallel track with the same issue in the Superior Court.
That is correct, Your Honor. I don't dispute that at all. And again, the reason why I took the position I did with Mr. Wallace, it seemed to me that had the certified question been presented properly the first time around, we wouldn't be here today, and that the court, and not to say it was inviting the question, but had at least was something it was willing to consider. And I thought that maybe through judicial economy, with my case, that could be done, and maybe I was wrong about
well, no,
that.
But they're two separate issues, as Justice Jacobs said. At the end of Morissette, I mean the end of Hoover, when we referred to Morissette, we're simply telling the reader what we decided and what we didn't decide. We had two certified questions under a very limited circumstance. So it wasn't something we had complete jurisdiction over. We answered the two questions. and we simply said this question was not asked and it's not being answered. Now, the as Justice Jacobs said, the question is, should we answer it in the context of your appeal when the trial judge has never ruled, or should we answer it in the context of reviewing an opinion where we have the thought process of the trial judge?
And I understand that, Your Honor, and because I know that's the normal course that this court deals with, is questions that have been decided.
All right. You've got 11 minutes and 45 seconds to talk to the merits of your appeal.
The merits of the appeal, Your Honor, is this. In getting to the point, I think the facts as applied to the potential penalties in this case is the case you want to decide this issue on. The facts of this case is a situation that could have happened to any one of us in this courtroom. It was a young man who was going home from work that he had done 1,000 times before, had not been drinking, was not speeding. What I call it, and argued in the court below, he was driving in the perfect storm. It was dark out, it was raining, there was some issue about how hard the rain was and how foggy it was. As he was making his turn off Route 13 on the road that he had gone to his house 1,000 times before, as he was making the turn, unbeknownst to him, because of the weather conditions in the night and other factors, which I'll mention in a minute, he struck and killed the victim, a tragic accident, no other way to put it. Unfortunately for him, there were other things that had taken place before he had reached that point, the road. She had run out of gas on Route 13. As any mother would have done, because I believe her children were in the car, she makes an attempt to go to the gas station, I believe. She gets out of the car heading on the wrong way on the highway, which is illegal in the state of Delaware. You got to walk essentially against traffic to potentially see oncoming cars. Also, walking at night is not permitted generally on the highway. She was wearing dark clothing. The facts of the case are this, and is that the underlying charges, he made an lane change which was prohibited. And there's two parts to it, and I'll explain why. Initially, they had determined that he started to make his right turn a few feet before the dotted line of the designated lane change. And that's, I believe, part of the charge. But the other part of the charge is that he made it unsafely and that he should have seen. Now, the question would have been, had he made the lane change within the designated line, that he was still unsafe by not observing her. And the reason why I point that out is because these are facts that could have applied to any one of us while driving down the road. It was a moment of inattention at best. And he is facing the potential penalties of 30 months in jail. Now, is it likely that he's to get 30 months in jail? Not likely. However, the potentially exists. And ultimately, what Morissette decided and what it relied upon was a law review article, which is continuously cited. In fact, this court cited to it as well. It's a Columbia Law Review article that deals with public welfare offenses. And in that public welfare offenses article, the main gist of it is this, that the small penalty which they were describing were fine-like, no imprisonment. And that's what Morissette relied upon heavily. So we get from the situation where we're at a fine-like situation to now we're at a felony-level type punishment of approximately 30 months. Now, the state, I believe, was the author of this legislation. And they, when they submitted the bill up, the crime was classified as an unclassified misdemeanor. As we all know, carries up to 30 days in jail and up to $500 fines. If that would have been the case, I don't think I would have any argument as to the due process. But that's not what happened here. What they then added on was a felony-level punishment.
Who's they?
The bill that was submitted and then ultimately accepted by the legislation. I believe, and it may have, in fact, been Mr. Wiles who was involved in this, because, and the reason why I know this is because our case.
But ultimately, they was the General Assembly and the
government. That is correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry. They added a 30-month punishment onto this. And again, that range is between an F and a G felony level.
But did they classify it as a felony?
No, they classify it as unclassified misdemeanor. But Morissette doesn't, I don't think, make that distinction. It makes the distinction between a relatively small penalty. Now, they also –
Well, but they also talk about reputation.
Correct.
And isn't there a huge difference between an unclassified misdemeanor and a felony in terms of being bonded, in terms of applying for government work, and so on and so on?
There is.
Does that make no difference?
I think it doesn't make a difference because it was an and proposition for Morissette. It said it wouldn't violate due process if it was a relatively small penalty, and it didn't disperse one's reputation. So the fact that the penalty could be severe, which I would argue that it is, would be sufficient. Now, had, for example, hypothetically, the crime would have been just an unclassified misdemeanor, again, I don't think I would have any logical argument to say unclassified misdemeanor and the charge of operating a motor vehicle causing death would besmirch one's reputation. However, if I change that fact pattern and it says where someone actually receives 30 months in jail, at that point, yes, it could damage one's reputation. And the reason being is because once that person got out of jail, they would have to always explain, well, why did you spend 2.5 years in jail, which could affect employment, friends, things of that nature.
What if the statute provided for a limit of 12 months rather than 30 months?
I think we're close at that point, and I knew that one of those questions was going to come to me because that's what I tried to work my way through. My cutting off period, at least in my mind, is anything above a misdemeanor level.
Which is?
1 year in jail. 0 to 1 year in jail is a misdemeanor. Once we get beyond that, we're talking about felonies. Felony penalties, I don't think in any shape, form, or fashion has ever meant to be a small penalty. That's why our punishment levels are graduated. We deal with motor vehicle violations, small fines at most. Unclassified misdemeanors carries up to 0 to 30 days in jail. Class B misdemeanors, 0 to 6 months, and anything above 1 year is a felony.
In essence, what you're saying is that an unclassified misdemeanor, which carries a penalty of up to 30 months in prison, is a historical anomaly for Delaware. It's nothing like that's ever happened before.
And I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, it was rhetorical.
So okay.
The answer is yes.
Okay. I was thinking about something else, and I apologize for that. But, you know, and I guess the question becomes, and Mr. Wallace made the statement, is small relative to what? And I agree. You have to make that assessment. And I don't think there's a great legal analysis in some regards. It's an up-and-down vote. Do you think 30 months in jail for an offense as Mr. Atkins is facing for an event that could have happened to any one of us?
Well, actually, the argument is anything other than 12 months.
Other than 12 months is because that's what...
And anything under 12 months would not be a due process violation under your theory.
The gray area for me is between 30 and 1 year.
Right.
That's
anything
the gray
under
area.
A year is constitutionally okay. Anything above 1 year...
I tried to somehow analyze the situation. To me, an unclassified misdemeanor is a relatively small penalty. Anything above 1 year, anything between 30 days and a year is where I believe is a gray area for me, quite frankly. 6 months could be considered a relatively small penalty. You know,
you're asking us to draw a line, and I'm asking you to tell us clearly what the line is.
I think an unclassified misdemeanor is the clear line for me as to being relatively small. Anything beyond that, I think there's a good argument that serving, example,
meaning,
I think...
That if the statute provided for no more than a year...
At that point, I think that would lessen my argument tremendously. To me, the 1 year is very important because of the difference this state has taken between misdemeanor-level offenses and felony-level offenses.
Well, in addition to lessening your argument significantly, would you have an argument?
That something less than 1 year could be substantial?
If the statute did not authorize a jail sentence for more than 1 year.
I think I still can make an argument that 10 months in jail could be substantial.
Okay, so your line is even below 1 year.
I think my line is at 1 month, Your Honor, and that would be the unclassified misdemeanor, and that's what I say. My gray area then becomes between the 1 month for an unclassified misdemeanor, which has traditionally dealt with violations and things of that nature.
As I understand the heart of your argument, it goes to this distinction between a felony-like punishment for an unclassified misdemeanor as opposed to a misdemeanor punishment.
Correct.
The other states that have upheld similar statutes, whether they're called negligent homicide or whatever they're called, and Michigan and North Carolina, for example, at least their intermediate courts of appeal have said penalties up to 2 years are okay.
Correct.
What kind of rationale did they use for determining that 2 years is okay, 1 year would have been okay, but 30 months might not have been?
I don't think there was much of a rationale, Your Honor, from my reading of the cases. As Mr. Wiles has suggested, this is a very murky area of the law. In fact, the Staples case, I believe, said there is no calculator or any fine way to define what is a small relative penalty. The only thing I can suggest, for example, in the state's brief, they cited to U.S. versus Wolf, which was a Sixth Circuit case, where they found 2 years to be severe. And they relied upon the case of U.S. versus Pierre, which was also U.S. District Court, which also had previously held that 2 years was severe.
Well, what about Ewing versus California, which seems to suggest that the United States Supreme Court believes that state legislatures generally select the sentence and it can be based on a variety of justifications and rationales? Why would, if they make that sort of principled statement, why would we second-guess the legislature, no matter how we may personally disagree with their social policy?
Because the due process still comes into play, and I think Morissette still comes into play, in which it's very clear. Morissette is still the seminal case which says it has to be a relatively small penalty, and that's the issue, is whether 30 months is that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, to pick up on the Chief Justice's last question, it's not only the United States Supreme Court that has said that. This Court has said the same thing. In State versus Sturgis, just in the last year, it has said that. That public policy as to what are the just deserts for a particular crime are matters of the legislature, and there are bounds on it. Certainly, there are Eighth Amendment bounds on it. There are due process bounds on it. But I would suggest respectfully that this was a carefully crafted statute which tried to balance all of the possibilities and to ensure that it stayed within what is permissible under the due process. That's why it's not a felony. I can tell the court, yes, it's no secret to the court, obviously, because you saw that I had to speak to the Senate about it, that I knew as it was coming through, at first they wanted a felony. We suggested that's not a good idea.
Well, why not minimum mandatories?
Or minimum mandatories.
I'm surprised mandatories. They didn't want that.
Well, believe it or not, Your Honor, I actually talked them out of that. But there's
what's the highest range now for other misdemeanors?
For other misdemeanors, it is up to 1 year, Class A misdemeanor.
So this is standing alone as a misdemeanor at 30 months.
I believe it is. Although I can't say with 100% surety, because I know that 4206, the unclassified misdemeanor statute, which permits a penalty to be also described by the statute. That's what permits this one in particular. It says if the legislature doesn't tell us what the penalty is, it's a default of 30 days. The problem is if we said the default here was 30 days or 30 days should be the line, then actually the penalty for this statute would be less than some of the other rules of the road statutes, which are the predicate for this. In other words, you can kill somebody and get a lesser statute, a lesser penalty if you were to be charged with this.
We talked a lot about different motor vehicle offenses in Hoover. Let's take the facts of this case in a couple of variations and help us think it through. As I understand it, in this case, there's a solid white line. You don't go on to the shoulder. And then at a point where you could make a turn, there was a curved line where you could pull over a little early and then make a turn. And in this particular case, the person was hit while the still was a solid white line.
Yes.
In other words, the individual pulled over too early to start to make the turn.
Would have actually been in the shoulder. That's my understanding. And,
all right. Now, my question is, let's suppose that you wanted to pull over for any reason, just to pull over. You weren't going to make a turn. And you start to pull over when you have a solid white line to stop, you know, to talk on your cell phone, do anything. But you strike someone when you've pulled over. Have you violated any motor vehicle statute?
I believe you have, but I can't recall what it is. It may even be this underlying statute, because what the statute says is you cannot make that change until you have checked to ensure that it can be done safely. See, the problem with Mr. Adkins is he doesn't think he violated that traffic statute, and that's what drives all this. In which case, guess what? He won't have to worry about any sentence. He's not guilty.
So what you're going back to my example then, if you have a dark, rainy, foggy night and a pedestrian in dark clothes, you would say, I checked, but no one could have ever seen this person. And so that would be your defense to the motor vehicle charge, which would ultimately be your defense to the corollary charge.
And I think the way that the statute is written, that is a defense, that yes, I did check, but yes, nobody could tell. And, I mean, I don't want to leave the court with the impression that I fully agree with the factual recitation of the Superior Court in this case, because there was no factual findings. We went by the warrant and basically oral argument. There was no
I know, you've answered my question, and your time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.